From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Before the war with Iraq, Thomas Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times, gave his qualified support for the war. Now he thinks that if we succeed in building a more democratic society in Iraq, it could change the whole Middle East for the better. But if we fail, we're in big trouble. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Friedman about post-Saddam Iraq and how Iraq's future connects with the Middle East peace process. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Wife, the new novel by Meg Wolitzer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The former U.S. general who will oversee the reconstruction of Iraq arrived today in Baghdad. Jay Garner visited a big hospital in the capital city that was stripped by looters when the city fell. He promised doctors that the U.S. would help, but warned that it would take time. Garner heads the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Aid, which is assigned to coordinate the delivery of supplies and supervise the restoration of Iraq's infrastructure. About 2,000 Shiite Muslims marched through Baghdad today, protesting the reported arrest of a leading cleric by U.S. forces. The BBC's Richard Galpin has more.
The protesters pushed up against the barbed wire barricades, behind which stood American soldiers armed with automatic weapons. But the organizers of the march managed to keep the situation under control. One Shiite cleric told the BBC they'd come to demand the release of three mullahs, who they said had been arrested on Sunday night by American forces. One mullah warned the Americans that the situation in the country could explode if they were not careful.
Richard Galpin of the BBC. The U.S. Central Command had no comment on the reported arrests. The Syrian foreign minister is welcoming President Bush's recent positive remarks about his country. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Damascus.
Syria's foreign minister, Fadouk al-Shara, said his country wants constructive and positive dialogue with the U.S. In a news conference with Spain's foreign minister, Shara said he welcomed a planned visit to Damascus by Secretary of State Colin Powell. He suggested it would help reduce tensions between the two countries. Syria has been facing intense U.S. pressure, but on Sunday, President Bush praised Syrian cooperation. Bush told reporters that Syria was responding to U.S. calls not to shelter members of the former Iraqi regime. On Sunday, an Iraqi opposition group said Saddam's son-in-law and former bodyguard had left their hiding places in Syria and turned themselves in. When asked if Damascus had played a role in the matter, Foreign Minister Shara declined to comment. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Damascus.
The head of American Airlines apologized today for not telling the airline's unions about lucrative new compensation and pension plans for top executives while the union members were voting to accept pay cuts. At least two of the airline's three major unions are considering having their members vote again on the concession plans after expressing their outrage over the executive compensation. Donald Carty told a news conference today that he didn't intend to mislead the unions, but he maintained that the airline is still on the verge of bankruptcy. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 8 points to close at 8,328 in active trading. Advancing issues led declines by a small margin. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost a point. It closed at 1,424. This is NPR News. The State Department says a top diplomat will hold direct talks with North Korean officials in Beijing this week. Assistant Secretary of State James Kelly will lead a U.S. delegation to discuss North Korea's nuclear programs. The status of the talks was in question after North Korea issued a statement last week saying it was making progress toward reprocessing used nuclear fuel rods. Material from the fuel rods could be used to produce nuclear weapons. North Korea has insisted on direct talks with the U.S., but the Bush administration has said it wants South Korea and Japan to be included. Thousands of children took part in the annual Easter egg roll at the White House today, but the event was scaled down and restricted to military families. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
The White House cited security concerns as the reason for the changes. With President Bush out of town, the egg roll was hosted by Liz Cheney, the wife of the vice president. She told the children the nation is proud of what their parents do.
One of the most important messages I have to deliver today is to all the little kids here. We think your moms and dads are terrific.
Then Cheney picked up a whistle to start the first of the day's races. From the starting line, children coaxed and catapulted colored eggs across the South Lawn. More than 5,000 eggs were hard-boiled and dyed for the races by White House chefs, and every child received a painted wooden egg as a souvenir, printed with the signatures of the President and First Lady. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street. The S&P 500 lost a point today to close at 892. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, reminding listeners that more than 31 million Americans are at risk of hunger every day. On the web at helpstophunger.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Tom Friedman says now that the United States has the primary responsibility for normalizing Iraq, if the water doesn't flow, if the food doesn't arrive, if the rains don't come, and if the sun doesn't shine, it's America's fault. We'd better get used to it. We'd better make things right. We'd better do it soon. He also says that if we do it right in Iraq, we can help remake the Middle East for the better. But if we don't do it right, we're in trouble. Friedman is foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times and is the author of the best-selling books From Beirut to Jerusalem, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, and Longitudes and Attitudes. He won Pulitzer Prizes for his reporting from Beirut and Jerusalem. I spoke with him this morning. One of the goals of the war has been the liberation of Iraq, yet there have already been Iraqi protests calling for Americans to leave, such as the recent protests by Iraqi Shiite Muslims who are also calling for an Islamic fundamentalist government. I asked Tom Friedman if he expects we'll encounter a lot of such protests against the United States.
Terry, there are several responses to that question. One of the things that we always have to remember is that it is very easy for Iraqis or any post-colonial society to both hate their own dictator and to hate the liberator, to both hate their own dictator and to hate us, because in some ways when you have to be liberated, that in itself is a humiliating experience. So just as we maybe underestimated the level of resistance we met initially in Iraq, we should not overestimate the amount of time we have there to stay. That would be my first response. The second thing we have to keep in mind is that there are multiple narratives going on in Iraq today, and we must be very careful not to impose our narrative on their narrative. You know, our narrative is that this was about liberation, and our picture of Iraq, to us, the story of Iraq was the pulling down of that statue of Saddam Hussein on April 9th. And that was a very dramatic moment. But I think we have to keep in mind, if you looked at that picture closely, first of all, it was American troops who provided the wherewithal to pull that statue down. And there were only really several hundred Iraqis participating in that event. In point of fact, the most popular thing Iraqis did on April 9th and April 10th and April 11th was to go on a looting spree. Now, when I say that, I don't in any way mean to suggest that this reflects that they really don't want to be liberated. They're really a criminal country. That's not true at all. In fact, I think that looting spree told us something very fundamental. It was a spontaneous upsurge of rage against a regime that had looted them for so many years. And this was, I think, a quite natural and understandable response. The initial response was one of real rage against the Ancien regime, against Saddam Hussein. It's clear they don't want him. It's certain they're not going to want us for the long haul. The key question in Iraq is, will they want each other? Will Shiites and Sunnis and Kurds there, fundamentalists and secularists, want each other? And that really is the third response that your question evokes in me. One thing we have to understand is that in breaking the Ba'ath Party and in breaking the Iraqi army, we have broken the most pervasive and to some degree legitimate secular institution in Iraq, certainly if we're speaking of the army. Now, in the vacuum that's been created, it's not surprising that it is religious sources of authority and legitimacy which are filling the vacuum, because they are the ones that were there underneath the surface. And that's why you're seeing now this immediate upsurge in Shia religious leadership and assertion, and at the same time, to some degree, among the Sunni community, and to some degree, it's less religious, more nationalist, among the Kurds. We have to keep in mind, we have broken that secular source of authority, and we now have to quickly, again, partner with the Iraqis to develop an alternative, moderate, secular source of Iraqi nationalism.
Are you concerned about the difficulty of doing that, of creating a government where there's only been a dictator, a government that, you know, has been compared to Yugoslavia after the end of communism because there's so many disparate groups that were held together only by fascism, basically. So, you know, how do you create a government in a situation like that? Are you worried we won't be able to do it?
Am I worried? I am absolutely terrified. This is the mother of all long-haul projects. If you could pick a country in the Middle East that is maybe the most difficult place to undertake this kind of nation-building project, it would be Iraq. At the same time, if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere. It's going to be extremely difficult. We have to be patient. This is an Arab country, and it's part of the Arab narrative. And therefore, what happens in the Israeli-Palestinian context also is going to be very, very important. That's why it's so important for the administration, it seems to me, to try to make progress in the Israeli-Palestinian context. Otherwise, what's going to happen, Terry, is that if we are seen as cooperating overly enthusiastically with Ariel Sharon, any Iraqi who cooperates with us will either be labeled as a Quisling or delegitimized, you know, within the debate within Iraq. And we have to be very, very sensitive to that. And we have to be very careful how we operate in Iraq, that we not appear to be anointing any particular Iraqi faction. We have to focus on a process, not a personality. We have to focus on a process that allows Iraqis to choose and nurture their own leaders, number one, and we have to be very, very attentive to how the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the resolution thereof can affect our ability to work with Iraqis and for Iraqis to work with us. We don't want to create a situation where America remains so radioactive in that part of the world that the only way Iraqis can cooperate with us in the long run is in secret, like 22 other Arab leaders.
You've said that the West Bank is a cautionary tale of occupation gone wrong. What are some of the mistakes that you think Israel made with the West Bank that we should learn from and avoid?
There are mistakes Israel made in the West Bank, and there are mistakes Palestinians and Arabs made in the West Bank. And I think the two are interactive, and so I can't talk about one without talking about the other. The biggest mistake Israelis made was the mistake of ambivalence. The Israeli mainstream was ambivalent about whether or not to keep the West Bank. As time went on after the 67 war, as Arabs refused to negotiate, as Israel found itself in possession of these territories, in part not by its own will or by its own doing, but because the Arabs refused after the 67 war any negotiations. Nevertheless, over time, Israel's mainstream became ambivalent about holding on to the West Bank and Gaza. It evoked certain biblical and religious and nationalist sentiments that touched every Israeli, Labor Party and Likud. And what happens in that kind of ambivalence, Terry, is that people who aren't ambivalent take over. And that's what happened with the Israeli occupation, because the settlers were not ambivalent. They had a very clear idea that these territories belonged to Israel and the Jewish people, and they were going to do whatever they could, not just to settle them, but to create conditions under which Israel simply could not give them back. So what happened and what really went wrong, it seems to me, with the Israeli occupation is when the center, the great moderate center, is ambivalent, those who aren't ambivalent take over and drive their agenda. And in this case, they've driven a tiny minority in Israel, has driven the agenda for the whole and created a situation today where Israel basically will find it very, very hard to extricate itself from those territories. The second mistake, and it's related to the first, is that when the center is ambivalent, what it ends up doing is taking a series of tactical decisions, small decisions to get through this problem or that problem, and they end up with a huge mess. And you can literally see those tactical decisions on the ground in the West Bank in the form of, you know, scores of Palestinian villages now surrounded by barbed wire, bypass roads that have wrecked and scarred the landscape that connect Jewish settlements so they don't have to go through Arab villages, checkpoints everywhere. It's really become a very sad, and I would say to some degree, miserable landscape. Now, the same problem applies to the Arabs. After the 67 war, their response to Israel, at a time when Israel, I believe, was prepared to trade the West Bank, was no negotiations. And they've been at best ambivalent about negotiations for many years. Then when they were finally ready for negotiations, of course, Israel was in a different place. And so they, too, have allowed their minority, in this case Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and the more extreme elements of Fatah, to really drive their agenda. And their agenda was not to negotiate, but to confront Israel, and to confront Israel, which has superior power. That's resulted in a defeat for them, and it's resulted in the status quo being perpetuated in the West Bank as well. So bottom line, message to President Bush, you won this war because you had a really laser-like focus not only on what you wanted to do, but what you believed is right. If you don't have a similar laser-like focus in what you believe is right and what you want to do after the war, woe be unto you and woe be unto us. You will never do it right.
My guest is Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Friedman. He's foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times and author of the best-selling book Longitudes and Attitudes. Long term, how would you like to see Iraq affect the Middle East? The end of the Saddam Hussein regime, the beginning of democracy building. How would you like to see that affect Israel and the Palestinians?
What would be my dream scenario for Iraq is that something would emerge in Iraq that exists nowhere today in the whole Arab world. And that is an Iraqi centrist nationalist party that has a progressive Islamic message and a progressive political message. And that is seen as legitimate within Iraq. In other words, where the source of authority in Iraq doesn't just automatically go to the religious and the fundamentalist, but that an alternative source of authority is developed there that is authentically Iraqi, authentically nationalist, authentically legitimate, authentically progressive in the religious sense and in the political sense. My dream scenario is that would emerge in Iraq, and my dream scenario would be that in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait and in Syria, you would have a situation where people would stand up and say, that is real, that is good, I want some of that here too. If you see those two things happen, Terry, this year, next year, in 5 years, then I believe this war will have been all worth it, because we will have begun the process that we want to begin, which is our inability to win the war of ideas within that part of the world. You know, what I've said since 9/11 myself is that we do not want a war with Islam. We want a war within Islam. And the only way that war is going to happen in an effective way is not if we fight it, but if Arabs and Muslims fight it with their own authentically Arab, authentically Islamic, progressive message to counter the authentically Islamic, authentically Arab, retrograde message of the bin Ladenites and the tired old Arab intellectuals and Arab nationalists and Nasserites. That is the war within. For that war within Islam to succeed, Terry, in the way we want it to succeed, which is that the authentically Arab, authentically Islamic, progressive forces that emerge also be pro-American or not be hostile to the United States. For that to happen, it's essential that America be perceived as working to diffuse, if not to resolve, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And that means, you know, working to nurture the alternative Palestinian leadership that's now emerging, struggling to emerge under Yasser Arafat in the form of Mahmoud Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen, and at the same time being equally forceful in both telling Israelis and pressuring Israelis to you know, shrink back the settlements and create a context where a legitimate, authentic Palestinian peace partner can emerge.
Now, you mentioned the importance of the new emerging government among the Palestinians with Mahmoud Abbas as the prime minister. There's a big struggle going on right now between him and Arafat, and it looks like that government might be falling apart.
Well, in a sense, you know, Terry, there are two efforts at regime change of a tyrant that are going on in the Middle East today. One is the one that the United States undertook with Great Britain to oust Saddam Hussein, and the other is a velvet revolution, a quiet coup that Palestinians, through their parliament, have been trying to undertake to oust Yasser Arafat or to shove him aside. And both are related, and they're hugely important. And we need one to succeed in order to consolidate the other. That is, Palestinians have been empowered by America's effort to oust Saddam, and at the same time, to create a context in the Middle East where, you know, people can openly cooperate with the United States, it's very important for the alternative leadership to Arafat emerge, and that for Israel and the United States to respond to it with some really audacious and energetic diplomacy.
Do you think it's likely that Mahmoud Abbas would be the winner here, or do you think Arafat might win, and that would be the end of the new leadership, the new emerging leadership?
Well, I think that it's too soon to tell. I hate to answer you with such a trite answer, but this is playing out now. I think the United States needs to be taking on Ariel Sharon in terms of the settlement issue, and I think the Europeans need to step up and help Mahmoud Abbas literally oust or shove aside Yasser Arafat.
How?
If the Europeans want to be played, well, they give a lot of aid, you know, to the Palestinian Authority. And the Europeans should simply, in my view, announce a boycott of Yasser Arafat, that they're not going to meet with him anymore and they're not going to give a dime to the Palestinian Authority as long as he does not allow the will of the Palestinian parliament, which is that Abu Abbas be made prime minister, to be realized. And so, you know, the Europeans have got to step up to this too. They keep calling for the Americans to, you know, have more engagement on this issue. And as my friend David Mikofsky of the Washington Institute likes to say, you know, you want engagement, buy a ring. And buying a ring is taking on Arafat. Now, the Europeans are also entitled to say to us, you know, you've got to buy a ring too, and that means taking on Ariel Sharon. But I think this is a huge, huge issue, Terry. And if we ignore it, it will infect Iraq, and it will infect our ability to work with Iraqis over the long haul. If we are perceived as radioactive on this issue because the Bush administration simply doesn't want to follow up with Ariel Sharon, I think this is a very serious issue for the neocons. The neocons who were instrumental and I think for the most part right in urging for this war have also been the most outspoken in defense of Ariel Sharon. And the two don't go together. And they are going to see the fruits of their labor in Iraq, I think, diminished, not going to be completely undermined, but diminished if the United States isn't able to diffuse or produce some kind of progress on the Israeli-Palestinian front. Again, this is not a call to bash Israel, to compel Israel, but it is a call to have, for the first time, a serious dialogue with Ariel Sharon that simply says, where is this going? Where are you going? Not only have you been, you know, building legal settlements, you've been allowing tens of illegal settlements to be built by rogue elements from the settler movement. And we're just not going to be a party to that anymore, just as we have to be firm with Arafat.
So that's what you'd like the Bush administration to say to Sharon, that you've got to stop building new settlements and you have to withdraw from settlements as well?
Well, you have to withdraw from settlements. You have to be prepared to withdraw from settlements in the context of a deal with the Palestinians. But what you can do tomorrow is certainly engage in two very important symbolic gestures. One is simply announce that there will be, you know, no more growth of settlements, period, paragraph, number one. Number two, you could go out and simply fold up all the illegal settlements that have been built, in your tenure. And third, what I would be doing, obviously, I would be urging, is a symbolic gesture of pulling out one or of the settlements in Gaza that, to me, were insane to begin with. 7,000 Jews living in the middle of a million Palestinians, and would be a hugely important and valuable gesture, I think, for the peace process and for the United States. I mean, does Israel owe us nothing, for this war that it was not fought for Israel, but has certainly helped to create not only a more peaceful Middle East, but a better context for an alternative Arab politics to emerge that ultimately would be hospitable to a Jewish state in peace with a Palestinian state?
Tom Friedman is foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times and author of the bestsellers From Beirut to Jerusalem and Longitudes and Attitudes. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Einstein in Berlin, a biography of Einstein's years in Germany from 1914 to 1932 by Thomas Levinson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the connection between Iraq and the Middle East peace process. We continue our conversation with New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman. And Maureen Corrigan reviews The Wife, the new novel by Meg Wolitzer.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Friedman, Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times and author of the best-selling books From Beirut to Jerusalem and Longitudes and Attitudes. He won his first two Pulitzer Prizes for his reporting from Lebanon and Jerusalem. I think it's fair to say that people on all sides of the issue about the war in Iraq feel that it will have some impact on the Middle East peace process. What do you think is the impact the Bush administration would like it to have on Israel and the Palestinians? What do you think their long-term goal is for that part of the Middle East?
You know, Terry, I don't know. I don't really know. I don't mean to dodge your question. I hear the words coming out of the president on this issue, and they're good words and they're thoughtful words. His speech last June about the need for a Palestinian state and an end to settlements. I hear the words coming out, but I never see the action. I never see the kind of really forceful action on the part of the president on this issue. And I don't know whether that's because he doesn't want to lose votes among more conservative Christian groups that are pro-Israel or among American Jews. I don't know if it's because his heart really isn't in it. I don't know, but I'm at this stage in the show-me mode. These guys are big on words, but they're real short on strategy.
What do you see as the importance now of the roadmap for Middle East peace? Is that a document that you think can really set the stage for reigniting the peace process?
Do 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 do. I don't know how many times roadmaps and tenet and this plan and that plan. Do 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 do. I'm just so tired of it. I can't keep track of them myself. I'm going to really confess something to you, Terry, to you and all your viewers.
Yeah.
I've never read the roadmap. The only roadmap I know, you know, is the one that, you know, gets me to Baltimore when I get lost. And because this is like real simple. We know what the principles are. The principles are land for peace. The principles are Palestinians ready to step up and in a full-throated way recognize a Jewish state and develop their own internal security organizations to sustain a peace with that Jewish state, and are Israelis ready to step up and affirm the right of Palestinians to their own state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, and to withdraw accordingly if Palestinians do step up. That's the issue. It's always been the issue. Call it Mitchell, call it Tenet, call it Roadmap, call it Eminem, call it Madonna. I don't care what you call it. That's the issue. And until you see people ready to step up to it, we've got bubkas.
You covered the Middle East for a long time.
Way too long.
And you wrote a terrific best-selling book about it, From Beirut to Jerusalem. Do you think that living in the Middle East a long time and covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and writing about Lebanon as well, do you think that has affected how you see the United States' position now in the Middle East and how you see the war in Iraq and the future of our relationship with Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, Terry, going back to the beginning of this war and all the columns I wrote about it, you know, people would say, what is your view on this war? And I'd say, I'm for it 51-49. Or actually what I would told people, I'm for it 52-49. Because there was something slightly irrational, you know, about my support for the war. And so it never really added up. And it was always, for me, a struggle between hope and experience. Lord knows, experience from having lived in Lebanon, and what is Lebanon but just a small version of Beirut, should have taught me that the notion of nation building and democratizing Iraq is a huge, huge project, if not a fool's errand. Experience, you know, should have taught me that we just don't do, you know, these things very well. My wife was against the war, and when I wrote that in a column that, you know, I was leaned for it, my wife was against it, I was inundated with email from people saying, listen to your wife is smarter than you, I'm glad you sleep with someone more intelligent than you. And so it was always a struggle, but they see there was another side to it, and that was the hope side. I always say, you know, there's kind of two sides to my reporting. There's the Middle East side, and there's the Middle West side. There's the Minnesota boy, and there's the reporter who went to Beirut, and they're constantly in a struggle for my soul. And the hope side really came from my travel since 9/11 and the number of young Arabs and Muslims who have come up to me in the Arab world and said, Mr. Friedman, keep writing what you are writing. Keep calling for democracy. Keep calling for modernization in Islam. I've been bombarded with email, particularly from Muslim women who have made that appeal. And so every time, Terry, that I thought of coming out against the war, it struck me as an abandonment of those people, which is why I just couldn't pull the trigger on it. And it's why hope always triumphed over experience and why, for me, it was always, 52-49 call. I don't regret it. As I said, I worried then that we're not going to do it right. I'm less worried now, but I'm still plenty worried. And I'm going to use my pen to do everything I can to try to tilt us in doing it right. I think it's so important because this just isn't, for me, hope wasn't just an attitude. It's a strategy. It's a strategic issue. Because, people came up to me and said, how can you believe any of this stuff that you want to happen in Iraq is going to happen? Surely your experience should have taught you otherwise. And to them, Terry, I say two things. One is that if you think the status quo was benign in the Arab world, you're nuts. The malaise of the Arab world, it was the status quo malaise of the Arab world that brought us 9/11. And that was the first thing I said. And the second thing I said is that if you think there's nothing we can do to partner with people in that part of the world, to tilt it onto a more progressive track, politically, religiously, educationally, then I have some very simple advice for you. Stick your head between your legs and kiss your behind goodbye. Because there are just too many angry people out there and too many proliferated weapons before one of them just blows us all up.
My guest is Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Friedman is my guest, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times, former Middle East correspondent for the Middle Times, and author of the best-selling book Longitudes and Attitudes. Did living in the Middle East for many years and covering it for the New York Times also affect your point of view on the use of power and aggression? I'm thinking in a recent column about Syria, and this was last week when the Bush administration was first accusing Syria of harboring Iraqis from the Saddam Hussein regime, developing chemical weapons, and Donald Rumsfeld was saying he was going to cut off oil to Syria from the Iraqi pipeline. I should say that now the Bush administration is saying Syria is starting to cooperate. Things are looking better. But anyways, in last week's column, you wrote that we should stay in Syria's face, keep in its face. And you were saying very aggressive things about what the United States' attitudes towards Syria should be. Again, is that affected by your years of living in and covering the Middle East?
Absolutely. I mean, the kind of regime you have in Iraq or Syria, which is just a twin sister, these are not regimes that respond to social work. They understand, they rule by force, and they understand only force. And in the case of Syria, I was calling for what my friend Steve Cohn calls aggressive engagement, which is something less than military engagement, of the Bush administration and something more than the constructive engagement that France always opts for, which is really just a, a cover for Dancing with Dictators. But, you know, my chapter in Beirut to Jerusalem about Syria is called Hama Rules. Hama was the town in Syria where there was a Muslim fundamentalist uprising in 1982, and Hafez Assad responded it by leveling the town and turning it into a parking lot. These countries operate by Hama Rules, and Hama Rules are no rules at all. I have a fundamental rule about Middle East politics, which has always guided me since Beirut, which is don't come to a hockey game and expect to play by the rules of touch football. This is a hockey game.
What do you think is the biggest threat that we face from Syria?
I don't think Syria threatens the United States per se at all. It is simply, it's basically, I think, a failing state. If you go there, you know, it's like bad Eastern Europe, you know, in the 1970s. In terms of the state of the economy, it's occupying Lebanon. It's been occupying Lebanon for 27 years. It's just one of these retrograde regimes that retards its own people and helps retard the Middle East area. But they don't threaten us, per se. But having said that, while they don't threaten us, they are an obstacle to a more progressive and tolerant Middle East in two ways. They're an obstacle in that they are occupying Lebanon, as I said, the country that is most hardwired for democracy and free markets and globalization, a country that should be leading the Arab world into those trends. In fact, is not doing so because it's under Syrian occupation, and Syria's basically been choking the life out of the place. Syria still hosts Islamic Jihad and Hamas in Damascus. Groups really dedicated to only a violent solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And, you know, the Syrians today could be making a proposal to Israel for a deal on the Golan Heights, and they're not doing it. So it's just a retrograde regime that, by its actions, you know, helps retard both, as I say, the Arab world and its own people.
So the United States is really on the case of Syria. In today's paper, it says that Donald Rumsfeld is hoping that we can align with China to oust the leadership of North Korea.
Let's get rid of everybody. I'm after your show, in fact.
Yes, thank you. But that's the thing. I mean, how much do you think the United States could conceivably take on in trying to remake the world? And even if the reasons were idealistic, even if the intentions were the best and most idealistic, which a lot of people would disagree with. But if you accepted that they were, is it reasonable that we could change so many regimes?
Terry, it's only reasonable, in my view, under one condition, that we produce an Iraq in partnership with the Iraqi people that 3 years from now or 5 years from now, fair-minded people would look at and say, you did good. You produced a better place. If we do that, then we have the moral right and the political tools, it seems to me, to look around the world and say where there are places for us to partner with other people, we should consider doing that. But until we can prove that we can produce a better Iraq, I would be very, very wary about taking on in a military way the unseating of other rogues around the world.
Meanwhile, do you think we're any safer or any more at risk from terrorism?
In the short run, yes, I do believe we are. That's what I was writing about yesterday, Terry, that there was a terrorism bubble that had built up over recent years. People were doing crazy things. They were strapping themselves with dynamite and going into pizza parlors in Israel and blowing people up. And then their religious leaders were issuing religious rulings, justifying it. Countries were then sending money to support these kind of people. People were hijacking airplanes and flying them into tall towers in Manhattan, and other people around the world were applauding it as right and justified because, after all, America was strong and these people were weak and it was the only way to get their message through. This was crap, Terry. This was nonsense. This was fantasy. It needed to be punctured. And what this war was about, at some level, was the United States going into the heart of that part of the world. And going door to door, young Marines, men and women, going door to door and basically conveying the message that if you think we are soft, if you think all we're doing is sitting around investing in the NASDAQ, if you think that the threat that your terrorism poses to our open society is one we are just going to sit back and take and let that bubble and your fantasy grow, you're really wrong. And that was the message of Iraq. And I think in the short term, in the near term, it will have a very salutary effect. I do believe that. In the long term, I'm going to come back to what I said before. It all depends what we build in Iraq.
Now, let me use the analogy of Israel for a minute. Israel has a very strong military. Israel has been very in the face of Palestinians, and that hasn't stopped suicide bombings in Israel. So are you confident that even in the short term, our show of military strength will help stop terrorist acts against the United States?
Because Israel has not built it. It's not followed up the use of force with a political process, a political overture, and a political agenda to help Palestinians create a make-weight and an alternative to those dark forces that support terrorism. And that is the failure that they've engaged in. I hope we don't follow that failure by not building in Iraq and nurturing in Iraq the kind of alternative Arab leadership and voice, progressive, modern, hopefully pro-Western voice that will argue forcefully and sustain forcefully within their own country the notion that this is not the way, that terrorism is not the way, that suicide bombing is not the route to dignity, that the only route to dignity is building something of substance in our own country, in our own language, in our own religion.
So, Tom Friedman, do you have a safe room at home, a terrorism emergency kit, and a plan of action where you can meet up with your whole family if there's an act of terrorism?
I don't have a safe room. I have a safe place. It's called Bethesda Country Club. I have a terrorism survival kit. It's a set of Ben Hogan Apex irons with stiff shafts and a Olimar driver. I don't believe in any of that nonsense. I believe we have gone crazy in some of the things we've done post 9/11. People have come up to me and said, how are you going to get out of the city in the event of attack? I say, excuse me, have you ever tried to get on the Beltway at 4 o'clock and just get up to Baltimore for an Orioles game? You think you're going to drive out of this town in the event of a terrorism attack? Terry, my life, my motto is very simple. I am going golfing. I'm going to live my life. I encourage my daughters not to read my column. I want them to have as carefree a childhood as they possibly can, certainly as carefree as I did. If the bomb falls on my head, then so be it. But my motto is very, very simple. Leave the cave dwelling to Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. I am going to have fun.
What is it like for you writing your column now on the subjects of Iraq and terrorism at a time when most Americans are utterly obsessed with those subjects because our futures are at stake?
Well, this war was not fun for me, Terry. It was agony leading up to the war and then even the war itself. And for all the reasons you said, and I think it's true of others as well, or I hope it's true, is that I just really don't want to get it wrong. You know, I don't want to get it wrong for my country. I don't want to get it wrong for my kids. I don't want to get it wrong for all the people reading it.
Was it agony figuring out what you even thought? Like what position
it was.
To take?
I sometimes wrote three columns a day.
With different opinions?
With different opinions and throughout two and ended up with one, sometimes by default. Because it was always this struggle between hope and experience, at least in my own head. And I let hope win, but you're always worried that you're going to be urging the wrong thing. And in this day and age, when your column isn't just read in the New York Times, but on the internet and all over the world, and you're getting feedback not just from, readers in New York or your mom, but readers in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and in Jakarta, you take it really seriously. At one level, this is the golden age of punditry. Wow! I mean, thanks to the internet, you just have this incredible audience. And at the same time, people sometimes come up to me and say, God, it must be great to be a columnist. Now, do you know how influential you are? And I say, I got to tell you something. You may think that I get up in the morning and look in the mirror and flex my muscles and say, wow, you are so powerful. You are Thor. Throw down a thunderbolt, you know. And that is kind of this image that people have. And in fact, I get up in the morning, I reread my column for the umpteenth time. I hold my breath while my wife reads it to make sure she approves of it. Then I call three of my best friends to see if they think it was okay. Then I stew and agonize over it all day, you know, and see what kind of feedback I get, because it's just such an important moment. And I sure haven't gotten everything right, but I just want to get more things right than wrong. And if I can do that, I'll be really happy. But that's really the mode I'm in.
Tom Friedman, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tom Friedman is foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times and author of the best-selling books From Beirut to Jerusalem and Longitudes and Attitudes. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Meg Wolitzer's new novel, The Wife. This is Fresh Air. Wives of great male writers traditionally have played the part of being handmaidens to literature, tending the flame of genius, but rarely giving off any big sparks themselves. But after 40 years of being married to a narcissistic famous writer, the heroine of Meg Wolitzer's new comic novel, The Wife, decides it's time for her marriage to end with a big bang. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Wolitzer's novel, in the best comic literary tradition, couches its rough truths with laughter.
Just a few paragraphs into Meg Wolitzer's new novel, The Wife, I could tell this was going to be a book I'd be recommending to all those people, everyone from my close friends to my dermatologist, who routinely but thirstily ask, "Have you read anything good lately?" What a pleasure this novel is, smart, really funny, and socially pointed, especially, as its title suggests, about the role women play in marriage, and in particular, about the second banana role women play in marriages to so-called great men. This sounds like a potentially tiresome subject, one loaded with resentment, bitterness, you know, all that strident feminist stuff. But that's where the saving stroke of humor enters in. Joan Castleman, our wifely narrator, was once a star English major at Smith, so she's up on her Jane Austen, Virginia Woolf, and Barbara Pym. Joan obviously has learned from these wry, writerly sisters that when it comes to women pointing out gender inequalities, the pun is often mightier than the sword. Joan is 64 years old, and she's been married for far, far too long to Joseph Castleman, one of those men who own the world. There are many varieties of this kind of man, Joan goes on to say. Joe was the writer version, a short, wound-up, slack-bellied novelist who almost never slept, who was as entertaining as anyone I have ever known, who had no idea of how to take care of himself or anyone else, and who derived much of his style from the Dylan Thomas Handbook of Personal Hygiene and Etiquette. If Joe is a kind of Norman Mailer knockoff, Joan is, or once was, just the kind of woman a literary lion in training would have married in the 1950s, a bookish, pretty blonde co-ed who could knowledgeably admire her mate's vital prose and retype his messy manuscripts. But a lot has changed for Joan in the decades since, as his student in a writing class at Smith, she first fell down and worshipped the then already married Joe. When the wife begins, Joan is sitting next to Joe on a plane bound for Finland, where he's to be awarded the prestigious Helsinki Prize for Lifetime Achievement, a poor man's Nobel. He's daydreaming of thunderous standing ovations. She's mulling over the divorce she's going to demand from him after the awards ceremony has mercifully ended. Throughout the next few days in Finland, Joan fills us in on the 40 or so years of her life as Joe's better half. There was the messy confrontation with his first wife, the details of which Joe transformed into his debut novel, portentously called The Walnut. There are their three variously unhappy kids and Joe's long string of liaisons with minor poetesses and literary groupies. Joan makes sharp, comic commentary about the professional writing life and the characters who populate it, like Joe's stalker of an unauthorized biographer, Nathaniel Bone, as well as his up-and-coming rivals, like Valerian Quinnock, an amalgam of Louise Erdrich and Zadie Smith, who writes self-righteously of her childhood in a sod and snow igloo on an Inuit reservation. But best of all, what Joan is insightful about is her own situation and the limited options she had, and she suggests women still have, who want to be big-time writers. Here's the tail end of one of her ruminations. Some women work out some version involving elaborate child care or a husband who doesn't mind staying home all day with an infant, a husband who lactates, perhaps. Or maybe they don't even want babies, some of these women, and life opens out to them in an endless field of work. And once in a while, the world responds in a big way, letting them in, giving them a key, a crown. It does happen, it does. But usually, it doesn't. Joan herself was no Mary McCarthy or Lillian Hellman. She was too shy as a young woman to be an exception, and so she became a type. The wife. But in the very last pages of this droll, astute, and at times moving novel, we get a double shock of an ending, one that reveals how Joan conspired to fashion an alternative way to be a woman of letters within the confines of her time and temperament. Simone de Beauvoir, the public woman who wrote The Second Sex, would have been appalled. But Simone de Beauvoir, the private woman who lived in her own special hell with another person named Jean-Paul Sartre, would have understood.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Wife by Meg Wolitzer. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Oh, a mighty wind's a-blowing, it's kicking up the sand.
On the next Fresh Air, satirist Harry Shearer. He's one of the stars of the new folk music mockumentary, A Mighty Wind. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Across the sea, it's blowing peace and freedom. It's blowing equality.
From a lighthouse in Bar Harbor to a bridge called Golden.